This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Moustache Twirling 101, The Mechanics of Writing a Villain.
So I think it's safe to say that a story no good story comes if you don't have a good villain. The villains almost make the story as much as the heroes. Do you agree?
Yeah, if we're looking at a character journey which involves direct opposition like that, yeah, definitely.
So villains are incredibly important within a narrative, and actually a badly written villain, I think, is almost worse than a badly written hero.
Yes, I'd agree with that, and I think part of the reason is that we always want to know why somebody acts the way they do if they're bad, but we're quite willing to just accept that someone's good for no particular reason, and that the fact that they tend to be more positively motivated.
Yeah, and I think that in particular now is becoming even more of a trend, because I think it used to be that, especially in children's literature and in children's television, you would just have bad characters, you know, they were just the villains. Their motivations were never really advertised as being anything, you know, they were just the evil stepmother. And now, actually, that's no longer the case. And even now, we're starting to see a new trend of villains' motivations needing to be justified, even in simple things, even in cartoons. And it's becoming a lot more complex, and I think it's becoming richer for it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, this will be a bit before your time, but grew up in the 80s watching things like He-Man and She-Ra, and you had Skeletor and Zordrak, and really, the typical 80s cartoons, they didn't have to justify themselves particularly. But one of my favourite cartoons from that era was Dungeons and Dragons, and Venger was a lot more complicated as a villain. There were times when he did something good. There was one particular episode I can remember where the children literally could have killed him and gone home, and they chose not to because they knew it would fundamentally alter them, is what it came down to.
Yeah.
And Venger had the chance to turn around and destroy them and take their weapons, because that's basically his modus operandi throughout the entire thing. He just wants their powerful weapons. And he doesn't. He hesitates because they didn't kill him. He has a moment where his better nature just comes through. I mean, afterwards he kind of regrets it, but that makes him puts him way ahead of the curve for cartoon villains in general.
No, I agree. I think my equivalent of that would probably be Dick Dastardly. I really, the moment you told me we were going to do an episode about villains, the first person who popped into my mind was Dick Dastardly. Dick Dastardly and Muttley. And I think it's because he is the personification of the villainous archetype, except the comedic villainous archetype. He's literally the moustache twirler. You know, he's got that long kind of hooked chin thing going, and the very long nose, and the eyes as well. He's got the semicircle eyes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he always kind of
looks a little bit evil. He's scowling.
He looks like something out of a silent movie. You know, he looks like he literally looks like he's about to attach a damsel in distress to some rail tracks, you know?
And that's obviously where the archetype we're talking about really originally comes from, the whole sort of ha ha ha, I shall laugh and twirl my moustache, because it was silent, so they didn't have a lot of dialogue. You just had someone dramatically playing an out-of-tune piano.
And so Dick Dastardly has really stuck in my mind as a villainous character. But even though he's a very simple, he's a very two-dimensional character, I still think he's one of the greatest villains ever. Because, yeah, his motivations are simple, but he does have motivations. And it's quite funny because, especially with the racing one.
Yeah.
I forgot
what Wacky Races, isn't
it? Yeah, Wacky Races. I remember, I think there was one episode, you know, he spends all this time desperately trying to win. And one episode, he actually does win. And it's by sheer fluke. Like, none of his plans work, and he does actually win. And he doesn't know what to do because he's become so obsessed with actually achieving this goal that when it happens, he's just completely befuddled. And they gave these little hints that the idea, his motivations come from a self-doubt that he has, which is that he is this genius. And actually, the things that stand in his way are often of his own doing, that he creates his own obstacles. And actually, when he isn't trying to cheat and when he isn't trying to be villainous, he does actually succeed. And I think they hinted toward this idea that he was someone who just got left behind a lot the whole way through his life, and he thoroughly believes that the only way for him to succeed is to cheat because he can't do it on his own merit. And when he can do it on his own merit, it really confuses him.
It's almost like his entire purpose in life has been taken away, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And I think so, even though that's an extremely simple motivation, he just wants to succeed. He wants to win, or he wants to catch the pigeon. I'm not sure why he wants to catch the pigeon, but
Isn't it a messenger pigeon and he's trying to intercept the news?
that's correct. But like, there must be much easier ways of doing it.
You'd think, wouldn't you?
You would, but he has very simple motivations, but his entire character, his entire thing is based on the fact that actually he is his own worst enemy in that, because when he actually tries to do things the correct way, he succeeds. And it's only when he tries to mess with the system that he doesn't succeed. He's a great villain. He just sticks out, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And he's ironically two-dimensional to the point where he's almost not two-dimensional anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And he's a villain who is unapologetically what he is. And his entire purpose was to be two-dimensional because he was obviously meant to be laughable. You were meant to if from his very design, you were just meant to identify this is a foolish person who, yeah, right from the get-go.
If we look at the difference between an anti-hero and a villain in story terms to start with, I think you've got probably got a bit more to say about this as well, but I think that an anti-hero in story terms tends to be somebody who you're not supposed to root for, but you are rooting for them because they're either one of the main point of view characters or they are the main character, and yet you know that what they're doing isn't quite right. Whereas the villain, generally, they're not the main point of view character.
Well, I actually gave a class quite recently, one of the class, and we were talking about motivations. And I was talking about the difference between the hero motivations and the villain's motivations. And what happens is that throughout a plot, the hero has three motivations that drive them through the plot. The first is quite an innocent motivation. It's quite an innocent desire. It tends to be something like, I need to get out because I'm in immediate danger, or I want to go on an adventure, or etc., etc., etc. So, for instance, Frodo's initial motivation is he needs to return the ring. Okay, it's a very simple, it's almost a little bit idealistic. That's all there is to it. He just goes, right, I've been given this task and I'm supposed to be doing it, so I'm going to go and do it. The second motivation is the selfish motivation. The selfish motivation usually comes after you've hit the first problem, and it's normally driven by the character, the main character's biggest flaw. So usually their fear. So I need to do that. So we think Percy Jackson, his second motivation is that his mother has been kidnapped, and so he wants to get her back. That's what's motivating him. It's all about getting her back, because he wants her back. The third motivation is the heroic motivation, and it usually happens. You usually need to reach that stage in order to defeat the final challenge. In order to get that final bit, you suddenly become a hero. This you see it a lot in sort of hero story arcs where the superhero has kind of retired from the life, and then they get back because they kind of have to. And then in the last minute, they become the hero they're supposed to be, and they save the day, and they're selfless, you know? And that's kind of how they do it. So that you have these three motivations. Now, the villain is different. The villain only has one motivation, And this motivation just gets stronger throughout. And it's their inability to change that makes them even more dangerous. So their motivation is, right, I want to create this death ray. And then the more that the hero kind of interferes, the more challenges they face, the more they want to create the death ray. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That their motivation literally just gets stronger and gets a little bit crazier. So that's how you can usually identify a villain, is that they are unwieldy. Now, an anti-hero is interesting because an anti-hero tends to have more than one motivation. They tend to, again, like a hero, their motivation gets altered throughout. And usually what happens is that they're going towards one ultimate motivation. So I want to be rich, I want to be this, that, and the other. Except unlike the villain, that motivation will weaken and then strengthen and fluctuate between. Which is why you have this very unique kind of character who's neither villain nor hero, because they're not progressing necessarily, but they are progressing, but they're still stuck on their one motivation at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think we're having a trend at the moment, which is that anti-heroes are more popular now than villains, to the point where, and I think almost realistically, we don't often have, especially in stories that have a lot of characters, when you might have had several villains originally, now actually you only have maybe one or two villains who are just psychotic. And then actually most of the rest of the obstacles and the bad guys are anti-heroes of some nature, because we actually prefer to understand why villains are doing what they're doing. We want to empathize with them to a certain degree.
Yeah, and there is something obviously quite attractive and quite sympathetic about an anti-hero, which we will cover in a future podcast.
Yeah.
But, sticking with villain state, you couldn't have a villain and a hero without putting them so that they are diametrically opposed to each other, so that they are both going to get in each other's way.
Yeah, and usually the best way to do that is to make them quite similar.
Yes.
Yeah, the villain needs to demonstrate the worst part of the hero. The hero's ultimate, usually, yeah, it's that we're not so different, you and I, line that's overused to death.
Yeah. Well, if you think about all the, I'm going back to Harry Potter now, but it's a good example. If you think about all the things that Harry Potter and Voldemort actually have in common, and I don't just mean the transferred skills, because Voldemort tried to kill Harry, but the growing up half muggle, half wizard, and the fact that they were both orphans, the fact that they both have a strong distaste for authority and like rule breaking to a certain extent, and they're both inquisitive.
And they're difference. Both very strong wizards as well.
Yeah, and it's just that Harry, more than anything else, really wants other people around because he's been lonely, whereas Voldemort has gone the other way and decided that loneliness is weakness and that he'd much rather have power.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think there's another element, which is that, again, the worst parts of Harry is that, you know, Harry's greatest weakness is also kind of is his greatest strength. And that's and it's Voldemort's greatest weakness as well, which is Harry's a very loving person.
Yeah,
he's very loyal and he's very heroic. And Voldemort doesn't have that heroism, he doesn't have that bravery, he doesn't have that love. And because he lacks those things, he's ultimately defeated. However, those are the things also that he uses against Harry time and time again, and those are the things that almost defeat Harry several times.
Yeah, what it ultimately comes down to in the end is the fact that, yes, both of them are frightened to die, but how far are you willing to go? Are you willing to sacrifice everybody along the way in order not to die?
But I think, Harry actually isn't nearly as frightened to die as Voldemort. And, it's a little bit sad, but, Voldemort has an idea of his own self-worth, and Harry doesn't. Throughout the plot, Harry doesn't have much of an idea of self-worth. And it's very interesting. I think one of the reasons I really like Voldemort is because he is motivated entirely by fear.
Yes, so much so that he doesn't even know that he is anymore.
He thinks he's got all these things, but he's terrified. He's terrified of dying. And there's a real fundamental thing there. And you wonder where that first emerged from. And, you know, when we consider that something that a lot of people are worried about when they die is that they'll be forgotten, that nobody will care. And if we think of Tom Riddle, this young boy at an orphanage who nobody loved, who nobody cared about, you can almost see where it starts, is that he felt insignificant his whole life. He felt like if he died, that would be it. No one would care, no one would miss him, and it would just be over, and he'd be even more lonely than he is, and he would just become even more insignificant. And so then when he suddenly had this ability to, you know, perform magic and to do it very, very well, his self-worth went up and skyrocketed, but he could never shake that feeling still. And even though he may not be aware of it, I think that that's where it started, this fear of insignificance and this fear of not being remembered. And so he went big and crazy and then tried to live forever.
I mean, he also has a massive superiority complex where he genuinely does believe that he's better than everybody else.
But I think that that is born of feeling insignificant.
Possibly, but I mean, I think he actually in some ways had a better start in life than Harry did, because okay, the orphanage wasn't a great place, but they did look after them there, whereas Harry was actively bullied constantly by his family.
He was, and he
whereas
was...
Voldemort was the bully.
Yeah, this is true. No, it is an interesting thing, but I think actually the greatest villain in the whole of Harry Potter isn't Voldemort.
Oh, you're going to say Umbridge, aren't
it's
you?
It's Umbridge.
Oh, she's forgot. Horrible.
And I think actually the reason she's the greatest villain is that everyone kind of knows somebody like that.
Yes, she genuinely sadistic, nasty piece of work. As in, you couldn't say that she was really, you know, balls to bone evil in the same way that Voldemort is. She's not that powerful, but what she does with the power she does have is so utterly despicable. It's an evil that you can sort of get your head round.
Yeah, and I think it's she represented the worst kind of bigot. She represented the racist element of our society. She represented the very right wing, very mean, uncaring, xenophobic. You know, obviously, you know, her fear of half-breeds is directly translated to some of the stuff that you see coming out of, you know,
she could
UKIP.
She could be UKIP personified. She is utterly classist, claims back that she was related to the original Slytherin family and things like that, the Selwyns.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the way she looks down, you know, the she doesn't believe in the Muggleborn wizards.
They should be lesser.
And her attitude toward education.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's very, very real. And I think she's the greatest villain, because on the one side, you turn around and say, how on earth could somebody be like this? And then the same day you open a newspaper and you're like, oh, that there's a person who's like this.
Yeah, that there are some people out there genuinely like that. Most of us will have had the misfortune at some point of having a teacher who hasn't gone into teaching because they want to impart knowledge or to improve people's lives or open minds or whatever. They've gone into it because it gives them power over other people. They've been attracted to the role for that reason.
Yeah, and they don't realize and they don't care that the damage that causes. And so I think that she was the best villain in Harry Potter, because even though she wasn't the because she was relatable, we related to the suffering that she imposed on the students. Because most of us, you know, if we think of Voldemort as the magical equivalent of Hitler, you know, most of us haven't encountered Hitler.
She was the equivalent of the scientists who experimented on people in concentration camps.
Yeah,
in some way, much more insidious, but had less overall impact and power.
Yeah. So, yeah, Umbridge was one of the best villains. And then you have Snape. People are like, well, he was an anti-hero. And I just, my relationship with Snape is very odd. And I suppose we'll talk about Snape when we get to our episode about anti-heroes. But so there were a lot of dynamics in that sense with Harry Potter.
So, first of all, looking at what we really hate in a villain, obviously we hate two-dimensional villains because it's not believable. And why would you want to relate to them? A good villain should really make you think, Okay, I don't like the fact that I can see your perspective, but I can kind of see your perspective.
Yeah.
So one my big example for a bad villain is created by Terry Goodkind, who wrote the Sword of Truth series, which in my opinion has got progressively worse the more books he writes. Perhaps he should like stop now. That would be good. Write something else. But it's Emperor Jigang, who is, I mean, the first main villain gets killed off in the first book, and then they sort of try and resurrect him in the second book, and he's actually sort of, he's okay. Somehow, Goodkind's villain writing skills seem to go down with the more books he writes. And Emperor Jigang is just this massive, bloated dictator type figure who's got all this power and the way he wields it. There's no reason for the way he wields it the way he does. For example, every time they, it seems to be he's created just to generate fear and loathing in the reader without examining anything too closely. For example, every time they conquer a city, the women are enslaved. If they're above a certain age, the women are put to death. If they're below a certain level of attractiveness, then they're immediately sent out to be to service the soldiers in the camps, several a night, passed around the tents as punishment for the ones who are really attractive, who get put into his own personal harem. Occasionally, he'll send one of them out, and we're talking sort of hundreds of soldiers. And it is misogyny and rape and brutality, and it's constant. It's on almost every single page to the point where it doesn't mean anything anymore because there's no context. There's no lightening of the atmosphere. There's no good points in his character. There's nothing there that you can hang on to say that's what I mean. It is unleavened darkness to the point where it doesn't make sense anymore. So completely two-dimensional.
It's talking about that, and sorry, I know we're meant to be talking about villains that we feel failed, and I read something recently. I'm not going to give any names, and this person had this female character, and the story starts with this character being raped, and you don't actually see it, you just see the aftermath of it, and this character and the woman has stabbed her rapist, and he sort of stumbles back, and she gets up and she runs away. She manages to get out. And I had to turn around and say, why did you include this rape? Because this, apart from the beginning, when she first jumps up and she goes, oh, the place between her legs hurts a little, he then doesn't engage, the writer then didn't engage at all with the fact that this woman had been raped. It was a totally pointless thing to add, because then the character was running, this woman was running around, no problem at all, wasn't sort of hindered by what had happened to her. And later on, she hears a guy sort of asking for her description so he can look out for her, and he says, oh, well, she might be the kind of person I want to find. And this person thinks, oh, men. And I thought, that's not the appropriate response.
No.
Again, I'm not giving any names. I'm just saying that I was surprised. But then at the same time, I don't think that that's actually the writer's fault. I think that that is the fault of this big trend, which is that in order to establish somebody as a villain, we tend to tick certain boxes which say, if we demonstrate this person raping a woman, if we demonstrate this person kicking a dog, we know immediately this is a bad person. And it's a very tired trend. And recently, I'm going to talk about Daredevil again. Haha! Daredevil, the first series, had Wilson Fisk, Kingpin, as the villain. And he is, without a doubt, a villain. You know, he's a really not a very nice guy. And he is also the only time I have ever seen a villain who is so respectful of women. Like, very, very respectful of women. Very gentle almost toward women, you know, his female counterparts. He's very deeply in love with the woman that he meets. And yeah,
It has become a tired trope that
it's
the
become a
easy
very
way to.
tired trope, and Daredevil proved the fact that you don't need it, actually. And this person who wrote this story didn't need to include this character being raped, because these people are then shooting at her and chasing her, so we know that they're villains. We know that they're against her. We don't need this sexual assault in order to identify them as villains. And I think one of the things I hate when you basically think just by making a character do bad things, that's all you need to make them a villain. And I disagree.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I do as well. And that sort of takes us on quite nicely to George R. R. Martin's Ramsay Bolton from Game of Thrones. Now, I'm talking about the screenwriter version of Ramsay Bolton because in the books, I think he is actually a little bit more well-rounded, but on screen, he's so evil that we just basically get reminded of that every single scene he's in. I think we're supposed to think he's a bit insane as well. But again, I can't help feeling that that's a bit of a lazy way of establishing it, as in, you know, he's clearly psychotic in a world full of, in a world where it's perfectly normal for someone to get beheaded once a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, to really establish someone as particularly bad, they are. I mean, they've got him doing things that he does do in the book, but then the whole thing with Sansa, which doesn't happen at all,
No,
and
but it
it
does
was,
happen with
yeah, it happens with somebody else, but there's more leading up to it, and it's incredibly lazy writing on the screenwriter's part, in my opinion.
I agree. He's an interesting, okay, and he's not an interesting character. He's a despicable character. And I guess I'm willing to give a little bit of leeway, but maybe not that much, because there are some very varied villains in Game of Thrones. Some of
Yeah.
them are a little bit samey, but I am willing to give a little bit of leeway because I think that certain roles attract certain people. You know what I mean? So when you get Game of Thrones and you see all these people in the army, who are leaders, you've got the Mountain and stuff like that. They're all literally psychopaths, and they're in these positions. It doesn't really surprise me because I think that psychopaths are ideal for those kind of roles, so they are attracted to those kinds of roles.
Yeah, and that doesn't surprise me either. I mean, it's an extension if you look at the studies that were done post World War One, whereby I think it was something like 85% of our troops weren't actually shooting to kill, and it was pretty much the same with the Germans as well. And ultimately, the ones who really were shooting to kill turned out to be, you know, psychopaths. And it was kind of a good zone for them. And you could say it of a bit more of a hot topic, but of people who become snipers now. There's generally that sort of almost psychotic disconnect, and you kind of need that. And being a psychopath doesn't necessarily make you a bad person. You need some kind, you do actually need some psychopathic tendencies within a society in order to keep it going.
I agree, and that's the other thing. The moment you say psychopath, everyone thinks, ah, ex-wielding murderer.
Yeah, Hannibal Lecter. And
Yeah,
it's
and
not.
that's like actually there are many very high-functioning psychopaths and sociopaths who exist within society and actually aid society. And when the going gets tough, psychopaths actually make extremely good leaders because they are capable of making logical and unbiased and unemotional decisions, more
I mean,
capable than we are.
they have got that disconnect from the reality everyone else inhabits enough that they don't get overly emotionally invested in it. And that's actually a good thing for the right sort of time. And even in business and things like that, you'd probably find a fair few psychopaths actually work on Wall Street, for
Yeah,
example.
oh, it wouldn't surprise me. But psychopaths rise to the top, which is why in Game of Thrones you've got all of these characters who are in very high positions of power, and they're all terrible people. And I'm not actually that surprised because it's not very often that nice people rise to the top, if you get my meaning.
No, I know what you mean. I mean,
Especially in a society where they keep cutting each other's heads off.
being that you are set up from the beginning, because you've got Ned Stark, who what he should have really done immediately was imprison Cersei and tell Robert exactly what she'd done and get that all declared and out in the open. Instead, he gives her a chance to run away and pays for it, and his entire family pays for it. And it just
The
goes to show,
entirety of Westeros pays for it.
yeah, ultimately. What he should have done was been a bit more sort of hard-hearted about the whole thing. Obviously, he can see the flaws in his friend, and he gives her a chance to get away. She's not going to take it. She's not going to
Well, I think
accept the honourable discharge.
with him, he really doesn't like Cersei.
No.
But he feels sorry for the children. And that's where his real weakness is. It's with the children. Because actually, apart from Joffrey, who's just cray cray, the official terminology, it's cray cray. Like, The other two are kind of just sweet, you
Yeah.
know. They're very normal children, and I think that that's who he's trying to protect. And he's trying to, and yeah, that his honor ultimately is his downfall. So again, I'm not surprised that you've got all these despicable characters in Game of Thrones who are rising to the top. Because again, we see the same thing. Rob Stark, also dead.
Yeah.
Jon Snow, questionable, but probably dead. You know?
But I think that's the thing, isn't it? Honor and morality seem to be luxuries that, certainly in that world, that you can only have to a certain extent at the top. I mean, even Tyrion has to trade a fair bit on that.
Yeah. Now Tyrion is a nice sort of in between bit, but anyway,
We're not
we
going
could have an
to.
entire episode about Tyrion.
We could, yeah. No, it's more the fact that in the series, Ramsay Bolton is so two-dimensional that it's irritating, and that's what makes him a bad character. Not the fact that he does bad and monstrous things, just that he's that two-dimensional.
Yep, I'll agree with you on that. I think
So.
actually the one who I thought was even more two-dimensional in this series, not because of his performance, but because of the way he was written, because I actually think was Joffrey. And the actor who played Joffrey is incredible. I think he's really good because apparently he's the nicest, sweetest person
Yeah.
on set, and he
You're
was able to collectively make an entire
entire world hates you.
entire world hate him. He was an incredible actor, but the way that he was written was quite two-dimensional and lazy. And I think there's an element of the fact that in the books you almost got a sense of the fact that yeah, he was a little bit of a psychopath, but he was more kind of a spoilt person trying to see how far he could get, and he clearly had some violent tendencies, but
Yeah.
he was also a boastful, stupid little boy.
In the book, you have to remember also he's 13 years old. They make the children a little bit older in the series. So he's been spoilt and indulged all this time, ignored by his father and indulged by his mother, and then suddenly he's got a crown on his head and nobody can stop him.
Yeah, and he can just do what he wants, and yeah, and he has no value for people. But he wasn't quite as sadistic as he was in the series. Like
He
in the
wasn't.
series, you see that whole bit with him shooting the women, and
Yeah, he's not. He wasn't creative enough for that.
no, and he wasn't like that in the series, simply because yeah, I think he hit a woman a few times, and he watched Sansa being beaten and stuff. And he was a despicable character, but yeah, the way that they did him in the series was just a little bit over the top, and it got to the point like, yeah, okay, we get it, he's a villain. You didn't actually need to do all of this stuff to make us totally loathe the little toad.
Yeah, agreed with that. So I think there's definitely some conflict with the writers there because they produce some very good episodes and they also produce some that are, you're just like, what are you doing? Did you get bored or did you just couldn't think what to put next, so you added that in or.
Well, again, it's that whole thing, the need to say, look, in order to establish that this character is a villain, we've had him rape a woman. There we go.
Yes. Here you go, 20 minutes of someone kicking a puppy to death.
Only way to do it. And you're a little bit like, well, I mean, I do get the whole sort of, obviously you're trying to establish that, what is it, the three markers for a psychopath is, you know, hurting animals, starting fires, and little.
Bedwetting.
Is it bedwetting? I thought it was
It is
stealing stuff.
bedwetting.
Bedwetting also. Okay, yeah, you know, so they're trying to do all these markers and stuff like that. Also, like the other thing, another reason that they justify the whole rape thing is that they go, yeah, well, it's gritty, you know, it's showing what history was really like. I'm like, historically, rapists were treated much worse than they are now.
Oh, hell yeah.
Also, they're like, it's just to be historically accurate, and I'm like, if you wanted it to be historically accurate and not an aesthetic kind of thing, then maybe you should have the women not shaved whilst they're being
Yeah.
raped. Like we're gonna rape them, but we're gonna do it in a very sensuous way,
Yes.
and you know, like with sensuous angles and stuff like that. And I'm like, So yeah, it's a little bit.
I think this is a topic for an episode by
Sorry, it's a
itself.
topic for something else, but yeah,
Yeah.
it's the very odd thing. of creating villains, and a very lazy way of creating villains, if I'm honest.
Anyway, moving on from just the bad villains, as in they're bad, they're not great characters, they're just rubbish, to they're so bad they're funny. My personal favourite so bad they're funny villain is Ming the Merciless from Flash Gordon.
What am I trying to say? She is onto herself a caricature, isn't she? He is a caricature.
Yes.
Yes, he is.
If it doesn't bear up to too much close scrutiny or interrogation for racism, for example, because when it was written for Flash Gordon comics, and the film reflects this. I mean, it's a terrible film, but I can't help loving it because I grew up with it. But yeah, it was all about sort of communism is bad, kids, and being the merciless. Okay, he's green and he comes from another planet, but he's very reflective of sort of, you know, the Chinese philosophy of that time.
Yeah.
So Ming was more or less Chairman Mao, or pretty close to.
Yeah, but with the eyebrows.
But yeah, epic eyebrows.
The epic eyebrows, which were, again, we're going back to the silent films. He had silent film eyebrows. He had the drawn on.
Yes, and I don't know if you've ever seen any of the comic books, but sort of the gestures and the poses he holds, again, they're the exaggerated silent film type gestures.
Yeah, again, he's another Dick Dastardly sort of character.
And I don't think he was, maybe with the film, they were actually a case of, okay, he's so two-dimensional, we're being ironic with it. I don't think they were with the comics, but yeah, he's sort of become great because he's so bad, he's funny.
But then I don't think Flash Gordon, the film, was really meant to...
No, it's not supposed to be an edifying piece of media or anything. No. It's supposed to be fun. And it is fun, damn it.
It is. It's very fun. He's a great villain, because he is totally ridiculous. I'm trying to think if there are any others who even kind of come up to that standard of such bad villains that they come full circle.
I think Ming the Merciless and Dick Dastardly might be the two best examples.
Yeah, they are right there up at the top. Speaking again, sorry, we're going back to villains. Maybe, I guess it's almost from the same era. You've got Thanos from Marvel.
Yeah.
And Thanos is another character. He's I was going to say he's globe-trotting. He's not globe-trotting. He's universe-trotting. Wants to take over the universe. Wants to have ultimate power. And he's really, really powerful. And, you know, he's the mega one, like Ultron, in the Marvel Universe. Everyone's kind of terrified of Thanos. And he's a really dull villain.
I think we just haven't perhaps seen enough of him.
Okay, not in the movies, but, you know, I've seen him in the cartoons several times. You know, I've seen several versions of him. Like, I get a little bit tired of Thanos because there's just nothing unique about what Thanos wants and about what Thanos is trying to do, and he doesn't have that kind of comedic element which Ming the Merciless or Dick Dastardly do, because you're meant to take Thanos seriously.
Yeah, it doesn't have, I suppose in a way he doesn't have like the intelligence or the creativity of say Lex Luthor or the Joker or someone like that.
The Joker is another one we're going to have to go into, because I think he's another great villain. Yeah, Thanos bores me. Ultron is interesting, if a little bit predictable. He's the, you know, the whole against the AI thing, you know.
Yeah.
But Thanos is just a bit dull, because he wants all this power, and it's just sheer destruction. And you're a little bit like, okay, but why? We don't really know why you want any of these things. There's no real explanation for what he's really up to, but I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is some person who's read all of the comics will be able to tell me. Thanos has got a secret wife whom he's trying to save, or something a little bit like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But for the moment, I just don't really like Thanos. Now, the Joker is, I think, one of the greatest villains ever, because he's terrifying, because he's a three-dimensional villain who is also just a complete anarchist psychopath, and he isn't in it really for the money, he isn't in it for anything else, he's just crazy. And usually that's a very tired trope. Usually it's a little bit, oh great, they're just doing it because they're bonkers. But kind of the Joker was quite original when he started doing that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and he's got a big stake in, really, is being an opposite number to Batman.
Yeah.
It's almost like a twisted love affair.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that most of the time, villains tend to be afraid of something, or they tend to overestimate themselves. You know, for Thanos, it's, I am the greatest and the strongest and nobody can defeat me, that's impossible. You know, for Voldemort, it's the same, and it's the whole sort of, he was afraid of death. Whereas the Joker is terrifying because he's not afraid of anything, really.
Except being bored.
Except being bored. And he's not... He doesn't consider himself necessarily to be the best. He's not in competition with anybody. All he wants to do is he wants to challenge Batman. And he doesn't actually necessarily care who wins or who loses. And I think an element of the fact is he doesn't want really Batman to disappear. He doesn't really want Batman to die.
No, and it's really interesting, actually. I don't know if you've read the graphic novel The Dark Knight, which mm-hmm. is what they based the film on, but Batman's retired. This is Batman in his 50s, and yeah. everything's going to hell again. And he decides, you know what? It's time to break out the bat suit again. And there's a brilliant piece where there's a reporter saying on the news, and the Batman has been sighted. And you have this picture of the Joker sat in Arkham Asylum, and his face is just blank. He looks like someone just on the edge of despair. There's nothing in the universe worth living for. And yeah. as this reporter says this, his face breaks into this really, really slow smile till you finish with this manic, wide grin. And it's kind of like all the purpose in his life has come back because the Batman's come out of retirement.
Yeah, and so he's obsessed. That is his obsession. It's not necessarily with winning. He just doesn't want to be bored. And that's why he's so terrifying, actually.
Yeah, it's something you can't reason with. And I think that sort of brings me on to a couple of my really good villains. The ones who are written really well. An unlikely one, if anyone's ever read Peter S. Beagle's The Last Unicorn, King Haggard's a really good villain. And he's a villain you can't argue with on any level because he is just so far removed. He's not somebody who's kicking a puppy to death. He's not abusing anybody directly. He's a sort of happiness miser.
Mm-hmm.
But his desire for happiness, and the only thing that makes him happy, are the unicorns, which he's using the Red Bull to push into the sea so that he can keep them for himself. So he's unbalancing the world and the universe to a certain extent with this supreme selfishness, and he knows he's doing it. He doesn't care. It's the only thing that makes him happy, and he thinks the only thing that's worth it in the universe is to be happy, and nobody else is quite real to him. That's something you can't really reason with.
No, again, and yeah, I think that he's on the same level as the Joker in that actually he's not ruled by what the traditional kind of desires and things that we expect from a villain, so wanting to be rich, wanting to live forever. He's something that cannot be negotiated with, and nothing else can really touch him, which is why he is such a good villain, because he's three-dimensional, but at the same time he's also just so untouchable.
Yeah, I mean, he's tried everything. He takes in this orphaned boy and raises him as a son to see if it would make him happy, for example. And he must have all the unicorns for himself. And obviously there's one unicorn left who's on a quest to try and find out what's happened to the others. But she's disguised as a woman at the time, and she's losing herself. She's losing the sense of the thing that she was, the magical creature, and becoming basically mortal. So it's really against the clock as well. And he's certain that she is the unicorn that escaped him. And it all falls out in an interesting way. And even when he's being destroyed, he's raving about how he was right. He knew she was really the last unicorn, and he will have her as well. Even as he's falling into the sea, he's shouting this. Other good villains, there are two from Star Trek, actually. And again, it falls under the same category of you can't reason with them. That there is nothing you can do. There's nothing you can get a grip on there to say, okay, perhaps I can get that round to my point of view just so that you have a moment of weakness and I can get away. And one of them is the Borg. The Borg are pretty scary anyway, and they just think that they can run the universe better if everybody is assimilated into the collective and made part cyborg, part whatever species they are. It's kind of like the ultimate Aryan ideal,
yeah,
but without being Aryan.
but it's Aryan.
Yeah. And there's also the Vidians, which I don't think get mentioned nearly enough. And they're terrifying in a way, because they're a species who were perfectly normal, and then they contracted this dreadful wasting genetic disease called the phage, and they're desperately trying to treat it. They've lost all perspective of morality, so they just steal organs from other sentient life forms while they're alive. So there's an episode where one character gets his lungs stolen and they put him on life support, and they're desperately trying to get his lungs back because he's the only type of that species that they have, and there isn't a suitable, you know, they can't replicate his lungs because of the way his anatomy is set up. And there's something really horrific about that, because, okay, really disease there is the real enemy, but it's untreatable. But I think they might have actually unleashed it on themselves to a certain extent as well, so that's even worse. But how do you reason with somebody who's saying, well, I've made a decision and it's a case of it's my species or your species that gets to live, and I've picked my species, and in order for my species to live, I'm going to take your kidneys and your liver, and, you know, yeah. You can't really argue with that in a way.
I think those are actually the villains that I'm the most scared of.
There's something genuinely terrifying there, because you can't say, well, what you're doing is wrong. Yes, it is wrong, but from their perspective, they're saving their race.
I think it's even more terrifying. I have terrors of sort of being operated on whilst awake and stuff like that. I think that's the thing. I'm really scared of that.
That would have been good to know before I brought these up.
I'm just terrified. Oh, it's among a long line of things that I'm which I'm sensibly rather terrified of. And yeah, being operated on is one of them. And I think it's almost worse than being operated on by someone who's taking pleasure out of seeing you in pain than being operated on by someone who's literally totally indifferent to you.
I think that is worse in a way, because yeah. If they're utterly indifferent, it doesn't matter what you do, does it? It's taken the tiniest, last little bit of illusion of control you have there. Because if someone's doing it and they're getting pleasure out of it, you at least think, okay, well, I can scream, but I don't give them any information. That's okay. All my limit's going to be, I'm just not going to give them, I'm going to deny them as much pleasure out of this as I can. If that's taken out of the equation and you are nothing except you happen to contain some organs they want, that is pretty horrific.
It's terrifying. And if they just don't even look at you, if they don't talk to you, if they, you know, nothing like that, if you don't get any of that kind of interaction, that's terrifying. That's really, really scary, to be seen as less, to not even be recognised as a sentient being. That's terrifying. And I think that villains who do that are some of the scariest.
Yeah, definitely. So they're three examples of my really good ones. I mean, I also like Randall Flagg from The Stand, and his motivations are really quite spurious, as in he doesn't really know what he's doing for himself, except that he enjoys power for its own sake. And he's sort of like a devil metaphor, but he's so damn cheerful about the whole thing. He's like, oh, you're starving to death, this is hilarious, kind of thing. But it's not just sadism. He's got a plan. He's got a modus operandi. But
yeah.
At the same time, he really doesn't understand humanity as well.
I think that this is for writers out there who are trying to sort of create their world and they're trying to create their villains. If you are writing something which is part of a large world, so if you're doing epic fantasy like you know, Game of Thrones, you're going to have several characters who are going to be despicable in one way or another. They can be villains without actually being the evilest of the evil. You can have villains who aren't psychopaths. And I think that one rule, you know, I gave to myself is that I actually, within the Hamartia cycle world, I think there is only one real psychopath, sociopath.
I don't like him very much either.
No,
that's pretty freaky.
Yeah, that's De Giles, and De Giles is he's a sexual sadist, but he doesn't actually sexually abuse. people he gets his gratification from kind of just dominating them in every way. He is he's internalized his own, you know, he's actually homosexual, and he's just internalized that, and he's just pretending he isn't, but he really is. And there's a lot of issues there, but he's actually my only really psychotic character. And I think the only one, there are only two other characters who come close to that, and one of them is Bozidar, King Bozidar, who isn't actually psychotic. He's just really greedy and really cold, and he just wants more than he has, because he's just he inherited one of the biggest countries on the continent, and now he wants Hamartia as well, because he's jealous of this smaller country who are actually more successful, so he wants Hamartia. And then you've got Sverin in the second book, who is sort of a villain because he's kind of losing touch with reality. It's not actually necessarily that he's a bad person, he's just going a bit crazy, and because he was literally dead, he can't really connect with the living anymore. He doesn't really see things the same way, whether he's conscious of it or not. It's just, oh, well, it's death, life, that he doesn't really see the difference anymore.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
But yeah, so, but I do have a lot of villains. There's a whole bunch of people who are doing some pretty nasty things, but only one of them is a psychopath. And you can actually do that. And actually, he's not even the main villain. He's just one of the villains.
He totally needs to die. I mean, in my opinion, hopefully in a horrible way, but if not, just quick so he's out of the way.
But it is actually a trend I quite like, which is that actually having the main villain being more human than a side villain.
Yeah, I think I like that as well.
I like that. You see that a little bit in Avatar: The Last Airbender as well. You've got Azula, who is a little bit, who is literally crazy, but she's not actually one of the main villains. You know, there's lots of villains, and really in the end Ozai is the main villain, and he's also a bit crazy, but she's really the psychopath. She's also like a 13-year-old child, so you know, there's some issues there. Oh, she's not 13, what am I saying, but she's very young. I think she's a bit older than 13. But anyway, the point is that if you're creating something very large actually, and you want to mix it up a little bit, have one of your side villains as the psychopath, and actually have your main villain as a more complicated character. And then, I think that formula works quite well, actually.
It's a good way of doing it. The other thing to consider is what I would call on-the-cusp villains, which aren't really villains because you can't ascribe human or whatever humanoid characteristics to them, because you'd be anthropomorphizing. So we've got things like, believe it or not, the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. And you've got the Terminator. You've got the alien from the Aliens films. And the Predator. I don't know if you've ever seen Predator.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who hasn't seen Predator? But then again, you know, they're not necessarily bad for the sake of being bad. They're just very, as much as they are sentient, and you could argue that the Terminator isn't, it's just programmed to do something, which makes it even more terrifying because it can't be reasoned with again.
Yeah.
And the aliens are just doing what they need to do to survive.
Yeah. Again, they really scare me. I have terrible dreams about dinosaurs. Dinosaurs and zombies. The stuff that you can't even reason with. It's just, it's doing what it wants to do. It's just, it's there to eat you, and that's it.
Yeah. The trick with the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park is the dinosaurs themselves aren't really the villains. The villains are really people who believe they're actually, you know, the heroes or the protagonists, but they've created this problem for themselves. The problem is their arrogance. So really the villain in that instance is their own inflated sense of self, their inability to question their own actions, and the dinosaurs are sort of a symptom of that, because obviously they create them. Every film they sort of either create them or they engage with them, seemingly forgetting that the last time this happened only three people survived.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there was a dinosaur wandering through New York drinking out of a swimming pool, and nobody seems to think this was weird.
I think the main villain, the real villain in the first Jurassic Park, was the guy who tried who shut the defences down.
Yeah. And
he's actually the villain.
Yeah, absolutely. And you could argue in the second Alien film, Aliens, that the corporation, Weyland-Yutani, is actually the villain, because what they're doing is sending people there in order to get infected with the aliens so that they can use the aliens as military tech in the future.
Yeah.
So again, on the cusp villains, usually they're sort of a symptom of something much larger that doesn't get explored. So the Terminators, a symptom of Skynet, which is a much more complicated villain in its own right, in my opinion.
Sorry, I didn't get some of that. Sorry, could you?
The Terminator is a symptom of Skynet. You're the computer program that wants to wipe out humans because, you know, it's once again, it's them or us. And it's the them or us mentality, usually, that sets your heroes and villains against each other.
Yes. Okay, yeah, sorry. I should point out that whilst, yes, I have, I do know Terminator. I don't, actually, again, I avoid those films. I avoid horror in general, stuff that'll scare me. I scare really easily. So.
I thought it was worth bringing up some horror, so I did.
So, it's fair enough. But yeah, they're villains who aren't actually villains. They're more kind of tools.
Yeah, they're the obvious, that's what the hero is being pitted against, but they are a symptom of a much, much larger concept. And the villain isn't necessarily an actual single personal entity or isn't explored as one in that particular setting. So they're interesting to look at as well. I suppose it's a bit like your Lovecraftian monsters as well. Although
yeah.
I find them, they're not two-dimensional, but they're quite difficult to relate to because it's all a case of, well, you know, if we worship Cthulhu, then he'll kill us last. It's like, what kind of deal is that?
It's a terrible deal.
Seriously, that's worse than Curzon Dax negotiating the Kittimer Accords, where only Starfleet doesn't get cloaking device. That's stupid. That's insane troll logic. It doesn't make sense. Not everyone else can have a cloaking device, but we have to go through space so everyone can see us and fire at us. Hello?
Yeah. So Kirk's, we realise a slight flaw in the system. Anyway.
Yeah, we can't see the Klingons, but the Klingons can see us. And the Klingons have a more powerful ship.
Also, the Klingons kind of do want to kill us.
It's like, who negotiated this rubbish again? Anyway, tangent again. And we have probably reached an hour, I think. So.
I think we have. So I guess our conclusion is villains are great, but you need to treat them with as much respect as you would your hero.
Yes. So for all the exercises you might do establishing your hero, as in what they like, what their motivations are, what sort of background they have, you kind of need to do that with your villains as well. You need to know where they come from, even if you don't ever discuss it. It needs to be there in your writing.
Yeah, absolutely. So... yeah, and we'll do another episode at some point about
anti-heroes.
Do comment in who's your favorite villain and why, and do you disagree with anything that we've said, and do you have secrets for why Thanos is doing what he's doing, because I'd be very interested to find out.
Yeah, if you know more about Thanos than we do, let us know, because we can't work it out.
All right then, well, see you guys next week.
Thank you, and bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.